Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we continue our expectations series today. We're going to talk about Jacoby Lane, the wide receiver, and TJ Tampa, the corner. And joining me to do that is Jason Smith of Huddle It Up Films. Jason, how you doing?
I'm doing really well, Ken. Thanks so much. Enjoy doing this every year. And I got assigned two players that I'm excited about. So I'm more than happy to be here and excited to talk about these players.
Always a great time. I love talking football with you, Jason, particularly the draft stuff. Jason's extremely well-informed. He has a draft stream he does. He has streams he does every week, right? One per week?
One per week on Wednesday night. It's a live show, so you can get into the chat. And last week, I was very proud, Ken, did a ladies' night stream. I had 7 of the women who are active in my chat, active members of my community, you know, channel memberships and the whole nine. And we did a show, and they did so well. I mean, it's hard, as you know, to do a show with 8 people. You know,
oh, so it was a panelist show with 7 women on it.
7 women, man. Nice. And they handled themselves so well. And it was great to hear them showcase their knowledge of the Ravens and give their opinions on, you know, like the receiver room was a really good topic. Do you want to add someone, or do you want to give guys like Tez Walker and Bateman their chances? Just different subjects. So that was a very popular show, and I was very proud of that. And they got to showcase their own. But yes, every Wednesday at 9.
I'm sure we'll get into that question right away as we talk about Jacoby Lane, who's the first player we're talking about. Drafted in the 3rd round out of USC with pick number 80, a big slender X receiver at 6'4", 200, and got, you know, good speed, but not run away from the secondary kind of speed at 4'47". Won't be 22 until August. I liked how the Ravens weighted their draft towards younger players in the earlier rounds. So they took some chances on older guys late, like Bjornstedt, who's going to be 26 when the season starts, for the extreme example, with their very last pick.
I think this is the cost of philosophy, and I like it. I like it. They, you know, the big swings that we've seen with younger players or players who have a lot of development to do, you see that even in the early rounds. I think about Patrick Queen and Adafi Owe, who were just great athletes coming out at their position and needed some polish. So, you know, I was interested to see how the draft would change philosophically. And I do think we put a bit an emphasis. Maybe this was a mentor. Maybe it was just coincidence of results. But bigger, stronger, meaner people up front with those first two picks. But the age remained consistent to me.
Yeah, DaCosta mentioned before the draft that they were up from 4% of their board. And I assume that means of their 197 draftable players. In the previous year, maybe that was an average over a long term, but it might have been just in 25. They had 4% of their board be ages 24 and older, and now it's 18%. And, you know, he talked about NIL and being a possibility of that, which, of course, is one of the big questions that comes to mind. This was, I think, the last year of the COVID people finally making it through the Python to the end of their college career. So it might have been a case where there was some impact still from that. But the Ravens, I agree. I don't think they've really changed philosophically.
Brave new world, though. You know, I think the COVID, I don't want to call it an excuse because it was, you know, legitimate, obviously. But I think that you're going to continue to see older players as the NIL. I mean, we got players suing to stay in school at this point. Yep. So, yeah.
Not very much so. Okay, so Jacoby Lane, if you look at the college tape of him out of USC, I'm sure you'll agree with me on this, but maybe give your own spin on this. Outstanding jumps, enormous hands, a catch radius shows up like no other receiver. Well, maybe like no other receiver I've seen in several years, but it certainly shows up very extreme. Pterodactyl length and goes way outside his frame to make catches.
Love it. He makes the football look small. That was one of my first notes. He handles it like it's a Nerf ball. It's extremely impressive. But yes, the physical skills. The one thing I wanted to touch on, I would say first, is I do believe that his build-up speed is real. And one thing I noticed on tape is once he gains the advantage, he finishes. And it's keeping the distance from the corners downfield on the go route, especially. You can see that when he's not targeted as well. But when he gets you, he gets you. And it's not just jump ball. I think within the routes themselves, he has that build up speed quality. You're on mute, Ken.
Lane was, you and I did the receivers together, and Lane was on both of our lists, of course. Actually, I'm not sure he's on the top 10 for each of us because he's 18th for me. So I don't think he was on the top 10 for you because our big difference was over Surratt. who was picked, of course, fourth. And the Ravens went out of the way to say, you know, he's the best player on the board and whatnot. It's interesting that that could be true directly after drafting a different receiver around earlier. Because that's not normally how things work, that, you know, you 30 players later, the guy who is by far the best player on your board plays the same position as the guy you just drafted.
It's true. But again, that's the part of the draft, I think, where the receivers really start to stand out and separate themselves from other positions. And I think that's a general draft thing, not just specific to 2026. So your top tackles, your pass rushers are all off the board. Where's the traffic jam? It's all these different flavors of receivers. There's, you know, thousands of them coming out, hypothetically speaking. But yeah, I actually nailed the Jacoby Lane. He was my 13th wide receiver. He was the 13th draft receiver. He was number 15 on my board. And I had him at 76 overall, and we drafted him at 80. So, you know, I had him in the right range. I had Surratt in the right range. So I was very proud of that. But it's interesting to me, one thing stylistically maybe we could touch on in this episode is that I think that these draft picks may give an indication of how we want to use Bateman, because both of these guys, neither one of them profile as a Z receiver. They are bigger receivers. So, you know, my point to you would be that, you know, if something happens to Zay, or maybe, you know, when Zay comes off the field to rest, we may receive Rashad Bateman in Zay's role as that high volume guy, because Zay doesn't really have a true backup on this team.
Definitely worth discussing further. Let's get into usage just a little bit later and talk a little bit about Lane, the receiver in college, because he was terrific. Had 10.1 yards per target last year, 2.42 yards per route run. The big concern, and this is a concern for both Surratt and Lane, is the contested catch percentage is very high, 31.1%. He didn't have a great contested catch season, but one of the things that really stands out is that has 18 college TDs to go with just three interceptions. So even with such a high contested catch number, Lane probably is able to play some defense as well as some offense on those plays to make sure they're not getting intercepted.
Now, I think Lane, on those 2 points, his big area for opportunity in the NFL is to be able to get off of press and to really separate within the route. He plays very, very tall. I mean, he's 6'4", so he's already looks tall, but you just even look at his stance when he lines up on the line of scrimmage. He is straight up. That back foot is not back very far. And then within the route, you know, he's not quickness. He's a 6'4 receiver, so obviously he's not, point guard low to the ground. And then with the contested catches part of it and the interceptions allowed, he's very aggressive and physical at the catch point. Mm-hmm. Borderline push-offs all the time. Like, he is not afraid. He wants to win. He'd rather get called for an OPI than not catch the ball, it seems like, at times. So it's delicate balance. I think the receivers get the benefit of the doubt a whole heck of a lot on Sundays, Ken. Do a lot of pushing off, and it seems like OPI, offensive OPI, is never called. Go ahead, Ken. Sorry.
His big highlight of the season was that, I think it was Georgia Southern, right? They were playing in the first week, or whoever it was.
Yes.
Much smaller cornerback. He just pushed him way off in the end zone with one arm while he's catching the football with the other arm.
Right. Made it look like a Nerf ball. Yep.
Yeah. I love that play. I could watch that play, you know, 20 more times. Get tired of certain things. Yeah. What else is there to say about him? There were a fair number of short plays to him, even though his A dot was 12.5. So he didn't suffer with a low A dot. They did throw some wide receiver screens to him and try and let him make some plays after the catch. His yak per reception is okay, but it's not great at 4.8 yards per target. But they had some short and some crosser throws that they tried to make it with yak instead of with a play on the football and single coverage. I'd be of the opinion he's gonna see a lot of the targets that DeAndre Hopkins saw last year, where he'll be outside the numbers, and Lamar hopefully will have the trust to throw it up for him and let him try and go after it with single man coverage.
I definitely think that will be the goal. I see Elijah Surratt and Devontae Walker as your between the hashes, slot guys, different types. You know, Devontae Walker stretched the seams. Elijah Surratt, professional space finder, professional type receiver. So I do agree. I think the plan with Lane is to just let him develop as an X receiver. And, I was impressed with his ability to And this was something when I read on other reports he got knocked from, but I did. I something that I disagree with in my evaluation is catching through contact. You mentioned the short passes. It, slants were involved in that too. It wasn't just gadget screen touches. I saw him run a number of slants and, you know, catch the ball, dig routes. I'll include in those like one cut route category where he had to go across the middle, took a hit from a safety or a linebacker right after catching the ball and was able to hold on. And then as a yak guy, you know, you're not going to confuse him with a Zay Flowers anytime soon. He's just not built like that. But I do, you know, you see a head fake and he does fight for yardage. Somebody's got a hold of his ankle. He's trying to drag them. So you do see some competitiveness with him after the catch, even though he's never going to be a yak guy at his, you know, his slender build, his height. You know, he's more of a fighter, but I see some football instincts in him, Ken. I think is a underrated quality of his game.
One of the characteristics that I noted was he does a fair amount of hurdling like a tight end, and that would go with the fighting for additional yardage. He's willing to try some things. I really hope they train that out of some of these players, coach that out of some of these players, because it's a huge injury risk, and it's a really big lose the football risk as well. And I know tight end's going to tight end, but I really hate to see it.
Me too. No, I totally agree. There are a couple of examples on tape of him hurdling. And then the thing is, once you do it once and you get your adrenaline flowing, you have success with it, it makes you want to do it again. But yeah, the injury risk and the you know, for more than the injury to me is losing the football. You see guys lose the football all the time on that stuff.
Now, it hasn't been forever, and you're not as old as me, but you certainly were around at the time. In the mid-90s, the Ravens had Kevin Brown here pitching for the Orioles. Kevin Brown had the worst habit I've ever seen from a pitcher. He would reach for the ball behind him and to his with his right hand.
Yeah, his bare hand.
Pitching hand. They would reach for it all the time, and he said, you know, I've tried everything to stop doing that. I've gone to psychologists. I've done all sorts of things. It was a horrible habit to have.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, instincts. And I think that you're right to categorize hurdling in that. And then especially if you have success, he probably was hurdling kids from the time he was, you know, 12 years old, considering the kind of athlete he is. But this is a different game in the NFL, Ken. Some big men out there.
So one of the things that's shown up, and I've only been out there for the two practices that have been open to the media so far. So the rookie camp and the OTAs, and there hasn't been much of 11-on-11 play. But the one thing that has stood out probably more than anything else so far in camp is Jacoby Lane's catch radius. And so he is all over the field, and the backup quarterbacks, who is all, you know, Lamar hasn't been there yet, have really appreciated it and gone to him and fist bump him after plays and whatnot when the ball's outside the frame and he's still making a play on it. It has showed up regularly. He also showed up, of course, because he did a backflip after the offense won three consecutive ball toss nothings. At the end of practice, but my guess is that Lamar Jackson will somehow see some of the Jacoby Lane stuff that has already occurred. He probably has already seen it on social media, you know, potentially, although nobody would have been filming at the time that was done, or at least no media person would have been. But he would have heard about it. And my guess is he's while he hasn't really had the opportunity to earn Lamar trust points, which be of the most value, the fact that he's got Huntley and Thompson trust points have some value maybe to carry through that quarterback role.
And they watch the practice tape together and all that too.
Yeah.
And I don't think it would be a stretch to say that Lamar is familiar with him, his game from college. I know he's at least seen the highlights. You know, I would figure that you get a new receiver, you at least look at the highlights to see what you're getting. But I find myself on the optimistic side as far as the trust with Lamar, because we've seen how huge this is. You know, if Lamar doesn't trust you, he doesn't trust you. And it takes a lot to gain his trust. We saw with, you know, you could say maybe it was to justify their contracts or to, you know, make them feel a part of the team. But with Odell Beckham and DeAndre Hopkins, when they were on the ball, when they were on the team and they had one-on-ones, the ball was coming their way. Mm-hmm. And you can't say that about Bateman, as you can tell by his target share. Miles Boykin never gained that trust, even though he's got had the body type for it. But something tells me with Jacoby Lane that he'll gain the kind of trust that you see Lamar has with the tight ends, and with D-Hop, say, because it's just an undeniable skill that Jacoby Lane has. It's not just the body type of being 6'4 plus and what's his arms, 32, almost 32 and a half, something like that.
I don't have it on me here. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And it's, half inch hands is the really big thing. So his arm length is almost not a complete reflection of his catch radius there.
Doesn't tell the whole story, but I know his arm lengths are in the 32, like 32 and a half cat, you know, range, 40 inch vert, 6'4". And he uses it. It's not like it's just there for show. There are examples on tape in college and he's already showing it in training camp. So I find myself on the optimistic side of that, Ken. And, you know, I feel like maybe it doesn't come fully this year, but within his contract with it by year two, I think we will be able to say it's clear that Lamar trusts Jacoby. And I think that it is on Jacoby too, throughout his 4 years here, to get down to Florida to work out with Lamar, to work on that chemistry as well.
He's got some other things he really needs to work on from his college. I don't think he really had the want to as a run blocker be apparent on tape that I'd like out of a wide receiver. Now that he's a pro, he's going to be playing for the Baltimore Ravens. He's going to be taking some snaps where runs are called, and he's got to earn the trust of the coaches too to get on the field. And that's a big part of it.
Absolutely. Underrated part. Tough to scout, I would say. You know, I like to look at it in non-competitive situations as well, Ken. So if you're down in the game and you're just running out the clock, what kind of effort do you see when it doesn't matter? That, you know, if that doesn't matter as much, I would say.
Down in the game or up in the game? If you're up in the game, three touchdowns.
Up in the game, I think, is different because you're putting the stamp on it. You're feeling great. You know what I mean? Okay. You know you're running the ball. So, no, I'm saying down in the game and – you're just basically like, say in the NFL, like if the backup quarterback was in and we're just trying to get the hell out of here.
Okay.
Healthy. Gotcha. Like that's the type of situation where is my wide receiver taking his blocking seriously here? Or is he just, you know, folding up the tent? So I like to look at all situations, obviously, but that to me is like told me a lot. I think about other receivers that I've scouted, be like, this guy's just got that natural competitiveness in him.
All right. Really big news item for the Ravens recently has been the Stephon Diggs talk. It seems to be kind of a constant low murmur of it for about the last month. You know, we're past any point where it have any impact on compensatory picks. Now it's just a matter of, do you want Stephon Diggs as a Raven in a room that contains three young wide receivers? And, you know, we've Walker, Lane, and Surratt are three guys who you'd really like to know by the end of this year a lot more about their developmental path. If Stephon Diggs is here, I'm of the opinion it would very much suppress any learning of that, or, you know, suppress a lot of the learning of that. Let's put it that way.
Yes, this was a key talking point on Ladies Night that we had just the last Wednesday. And I went around the panel and asked them, because I can't necessarily blame anybody for taking the opposite stance, whether it's Stephon Diggs, whether it's D-Hop, whether, you know, you want to get involved for an A.J. Brown trade or something like that, whoever you would think would help this team in the receiver room. If you think we need to add a veteran, because, look, we have Zay and we have basically a slew full of unknowns, including the tight end room. You got Zay, you got Andrews, of course, but a lot of unknowns health wise and just playing time wise. Do you want to bring in a vet and solidify that room? I can't blame somebody for wanting to do that, but I kind of lean towards where you are. I want to see what we have in these guys. Maybe it's in, and you know, if things don't go well throughout the OTAs and the training camp, then maybe you make a move for a veteran receiver. Like you don't, Lane's a long way away. Surratt, you know, we're not confident he can play. Bates banged up again. You know, you have all these problems building up, then you go get a receiver. But I'm more apt to say, let these guys play. And if we did add a receiver, you know, Tila brought this up, DeAndre Hopkins makes the most sense if we were to add one, because he doesn't want that full-time role. He won't be expensive. He just wants to be in there in clutch situations. He's shown selflessness. So if we were to add one, I would kind of lean towards D-Hop compared to Stephon Diggs, who brings with him, look, you got to get him these targets and you got to get him on the field at the expense of others.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you. I think it... Hopkins would also be on the field at the expense of others. But another component of the argument that I would make is that the Ravens are a very old team right now, and they have some significant cost to overcoming that. And there's two things that are for sure costs, and I'll give you a third maybe as well. But the first is you have potential draft capital you need to replace these players at a later time. So that'd be number one. The second, I mean, there's cap cost to replacing them if you have to go out and next year get a Stephon Diggs, because none of these guys work out. So, or none, it's not a good example because we're talking about replacing an older player. And really, a lot of the age is on the defense, but that doesn't mean you just because your costs are there right now doesn't mean you can afford to take on additional costs at wide receiver, is my point. And then the third one is the developmental cost, is that you lose understanding of exactly what you have in your 2, 3, 4 players if you don't get those guys some action on the field right now. And in this case, it's 2 twos and a 4. It's about as bad as it could be with Walker entering his walk year next year. And, Surratt and Lane as rookies, they really need to understand that. So I think it's a multi-pronged cost that they take on a team like this that is already about as old as any Ravens team I can remember. You go back, they've got 5 10-year vets on the defense alone. Roquan's a 9-year vet after that. It's a ton of age on this team.
So I'm going to add one more point in your favor on this. And I agree with you. Like, in my heart of hearts, I think we should give these guys a chance and then make a move later if we have to. But also, not only just the cost, but we've seen Lamar work with less. We've seen Doyle be able to bring the best out of like a Luther Burden, in his first year. We've seen Sean Payton offenses, which is really where Declan Doyle comes from, to get a bunch of players involved. So I believe in Lamar. I believe in Declan Doyle. The counter argument that I hear to this, to people, is that, look, this is a Super Bowl window. We want someone other than Zay that we can count on to be there to win their matchup. So, I understand the other side of it, even though I lean with you on it ultimately.
All right, fair enough. And Luther Burden, by the way, first-round draft pick. That's an example of solving a problem of age, or solving a hole with a very expensive player. He's a young player, and yes, he doesn't make a ton of cap cost. It's a very expensive draft capital cost. So
exactly, yep.
All right, let's move on. Let's talk about what a good season looks like for Lane, and start us off.
Okay, now I peeked at yours. I find it funny that we touched on the same thing for a good season. My good season is pretty simple, that he's active every game. That's what I want to see, because the special teams is not something that I can comfortably project Jacoby Lane to play a large role in. So for him to be active means he's up there in the depth chart. And I'll add to that, just to show flashes. Show us flashes. Show us why you got drafted. Make a couple of nice catches. Come through for us in the red zone, even if your opportunities are limited, red zone and third down. And just show us why you were drafted. So I got a tangible one and kind of an intangible one in the eye of the beholder. Be active and show us your potential.
All right, fair enough. I am similar to that. I said active for at least 10 games. Here's my reason why I said it could be as few as 10 games, is that I think that he may or may not be a 3 or 4 unit special teams player. Probably a 3-unit special teams player is more realistic. If he's a gunner, say, and he's also maybe returning some kicks himself, and certainly we may see him returning some punts. If any of those things, then that may help him get on the field or get on the active game day roster. But it's a crowded group, and they may only want to carry 5 some weeks. He may have to really shine on special teams to prove that he's worthy there. But anyway, active for at least 10 games, play special teams in every game is active, plus 100 to 150 snaps at receiver. I would say, again, 60th percentile here, that would be between 8 and 20 targets on the season. Now, that's not a lot. At the bottom end of that, that's a pretty small number. But his receiving talent flashes with a play or two that show off his catch radius specifically, and he does not wipe out on special teams or as a run blocker. So he can't implode on those two places, or it's going to reduce his chance for playing time. I think he's going to come in short of the game limit if that were to happen.
Certainly. Same page, Ken. My expectations are a little high, or my definition of good is a little higher, but we're on the exact same page for that. I want to see him get active on his own, and he's going to have to play special teams for that.
All right, let's talk about what a great season looks like.
For me, a great season is that he is a starter in our 11 personnel. And I'm not just talking about in different situations throughout the game where you know, Zay needs a rest or Bateman needs a rest, or we're all banged up and he has to start. I'm talking about a team, you know, at near full health in the wide receiver room, and he has carved out a role for himself. Whether that means Bate plays more slot, more move. Again, I have a feeling that that's going to be the plan here, is to move Bateman around a little bit more than we've seen in the past. And Jacoby Lane finds himself not 100% snap guy. I don't want to put it like that. But when we are in 11 personnel in a clutch situation, say to start the game or to close the game out, that Jacoby Lane is one of those three receivers.
Okay, so the big thing you're saying there, here's the big takeaway from that, is that he's ahead of Devontae Walker on the depth chart.
And Surratt, yes.
And Surratt, of course, who's also a rookie, but Devontae Walker has already put up some very spectacular play in his time last year with, you know, 22.7 yards per catch and, you know, 8 targets, which is not nothing. He's grown slowly in 2 years. Walker has many of the other things that we expect to get out of Lane. You know, he's a pretty good run blocker. He's a guy who's going to be a high effort special teams guy. In fact, that's why he got on the active roster a lot as a rookie, and eventually was winning a weekly spot, even though he wasn't playing a ton of offense at that time. And then played every game, but might have been one short of every game last year because of his special teams largely. So Lane would have to beat out Walker for that. I think that's probably more than I could say even on a great season, because I expect the Ravens really want to know what they have with Tez Walker. And we saw them work hard to try and see if he could do the comeback routes during the preseason in particular, to see if that would be complementary to what he had. And then one of the big tells for Tez Walker for me was that Lamar went to him on, I don't forget if it was a 1st and 10, a 2nd and 10, but it was a play early on a drive against the Steelers. It was the season losing field goal drive. Let's put it that way. So they got down into territory to get there. But the 3 plays, I believe, before the Isaiah Likely catch, which put him in field goal range, he ran a little 8-yard out and got the catch there. That's a big trust play there at that point. I think the Ravens trust Walker to be on the field. I really do believe he's going to get the opportunity. I don't know if he should, but he's going to get the opportunity ahead of Lane to be either an X or a deep threat that Lane could also have. You know, Lane is a deep outside threat. So that's why I can't put him at the same level, but I'll just give you my whole great season thing here. He stays healthy for the preseason, very important, and flashes with less than accurate backup QBs. That's one of his best chances to show up, is he's just catching the ball all over the place when these backups are throwing highly inaccurately. He's active for 13 plus games, delivers solid special teams play on either 3 or 4 units. Doyle uses this season as a laboratory for his top 3 young receivers, and Lane is the beneficiary with 200 plus offensive snaps, 20 to 30 targets, and 8.5 plus yards per target. And I think his most likely shining area is to be like DeAndre Hopkins, a dangerous man to have singled outside the numbers. And his play helps the Ravens make their 2027 roster decisions at wide receiver. So I don't think it has to be a ton of snaps. I don't even think he has to be active for every game, but Doyle has to commit to try to figure out what he has because of a lot of these things.
Yeah, I agree with you. Tez has the inside track to me. I mean, he's got the experience now. He's shown some kind of chemistry. You mentioned that play. You know, in those 2-minute situations, the defense playing soft coverage, that's you know, and Tez running a little rounded out route, that was a big play, a drive starter against Pittsburgh in that final drive. But yes, I think that obviously, I'm not sure if I stated this explicitly or not, but I'm talking about towards the end of the season, not straight out of training camp. So you go through 15 games and you want to put your best 3 receivers on the field, and they are Zay Flowers, Rashad Bateman, probably, and Jacoby Lane, to where I feel like they bring different aspects. Obviously Tez is an explosive player. Surratt's a professional type receiver. You can really depend on him as a third option. I love him in the slot, but if they think their best team is with Zay Flowers and Bateman being those moving receivers, Ken, off the line of scrimmage, so your Z and your slot are Bateman and Zay Flowers, so you can move them before the snap, and you want Jacoby Lane to be there in case he gets single coverage, to me, that would be a great season.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Let's move on. Talk about TJ Tampa. He's a 2024 fourth round selection from Iowa State. For those who have forgotten about him here, he's active for all 17 games last year and has just turned 24. So it's not like the clock has run out on TJ Tampa, but there was one time piece that kind of has defined his career to date, I think, in a way. And that's the 4:59.40 he ran has kind of dogged him so far at cornerback. A very physical guy. We'll talk about this a little bit later. But speed is going to be the issue, I think, for TJ Tampa being successful on the outside.
It is, and it's much less of a concern with Jesse Minter and all the zone that he plays. I believe he ranks second in too high safety coverage. He ranks second in overall zone defense usage, and that's something that I expect to continue in Baltimore. That's something that he hangs his hat on, very Mike McDonald-like in the communication. And one of the reasons I pick these two guys, Ken, when you gave the option, is that I was so excited to get them because I'm optimistic on both of them. So it would make sense that I was a little more optimistic on Lane, even though our standards were pretty much the same. Same thing goes for TJ Tampa. You know, my opening statement is that when I studied Jesse Minter's defense, then I looked at Cam Hart, I looked at Tarheeb Steele, I looked at Benjamin St. Juste, and how he got production out of those guys as outside corners. Foot speed was a question for a couple of those guys. I feel like that this defense was made for a guy like TJ Tampa to shine, whereas the opposite example would be Wink Martindale asking his corners to man up while he sells out on the blitz, and you better have some speed on the outside or else you're giving up a touchdown. This is the opposite with Minter, where he wants smart corners, physical corners. And, you know, you remember him from Iowa State, Ken. It was TJ Tampa's show. It was left side, right side, press coverage, off coverage, the back of cover three, like an extremely smart, long cornerback who can handle any responsibility with intelligence. And, you know, you're right, man. Like that 4:59.40 took him from a second round pick to a fourth round pick. And it was a good corner draft that year, Ken, if you remember. So
oh, yeah.
It didn't take much for him to slip. And, so I'm extremely optimistic on TJ Tampa's chances. Now, whether he gets in there ahead of Marlon or Awuzie, I don't want to skip ahead too much in the conversation, is one thing, but I love the defensive fit for TJ Tampa with Minter as much as any other player on this roster, really.
Well, he had a good year statistically last year, played 148 snaps. 112 of those came during the first 6 weeks of the year when he was filling in for Marlon Humphrey and his injury. Injuries, probably, I'll have to say. But he had really good coverage results for the year. 5.4 yards per target, an 83.3 opposition passer rating. Two TDs, one interception, and one penalty. Made most of his tackles, 11 out of 12 during those for the year as a whole. I tell you, it was one thing that's shown up even more than that. And, you know, obviously, statistics would point to a bigger role this year in year three, all by themselves. But they put him on a sled drill. All of the corners, obviously, and all the defensive backs, this last OTA. And he is probably the most physical player with the blocking sled. You know, the drill was to basically lift up the shed, toss it away, and run and tackle a rolling donut. And he was the most physical in terms of what he did with the sled. It was great to see. As Starks also and Keandre Jackson, very physical with the sled as well. But it's actually a fun drill to watch. I didn't think it would be, but I love
Keandre. Oh, Keandre, by the way, let's give him a quick shout out on the show. It's hard not to love that guy, just the way he plays. Yeah. No, I can't. You know, if you don't mind, man, this is where I would like to plug my channel. You know, I'm one of the few out there that have TJ Tampa highlights from the all 22 cut. There's no BS in it. And a lot of his highlights are on special teams as well. So you'll get to see those snaps, yeah. But an incredibly physical player to your point there. That's what made me think of it and bring it up. You can see that on his highlights. Yes, they're only highlights, but you can see his willingness. And, you know, I want to add, 353 special team snaps was second only to Jake Hummel. And really the third place was Kolar with 293. So no other player aside from Hummel and Tampa had over 300 special team snaps. TJ Tampa, 353.
Yeah, I'm for 352, but the same thing anyway. And I know PFR had him for 353. I saw that.
Okay.
Keandre Jackson, we just mentioned him, but man, did he have a special teams year. And Tampa had a great one. Don't get me wrong. I mean, he made 14 tackles. He had four misses. And if you miss 22% of your tackles on special teams, that's really good. That's really good. It does depend a little bit on responsibilities, whether you're a gunner or the first man down on kick coverage and whatnot. Right. But it's a 22% missed tackle rate is good. And a lot of all the best tacklers in the league, the best special teams player in the league, they miss plenty of tackles. They just make a ton of tackles. Keandre Jackson was in that group. And to me, he's one of the really interesting Ravens to watch this summer, because not only do I hope he beats out a player like Kayvon Wallace, and I think his roster spot really is not in jeopardy. I think he'll be as either the fourth or fifth safety for the Ravens, but the Ravens are highly incented to see if they can make him into a serviceable back end split field safety, because if he can, he's going to have a long NFL career. Right. He's going to be a very solid player. He certainly, at the minimum, he'll become an NFL survivor who's the fourth safety on whatever team he plays on and can play that back end whenever you need him to, kind of like Anthony Levine and his dime back role, or McClellan and his special teams and backup inside linebacker role. I mean, he's got survivor written all over him, and the Ravens are highly, highly incented to get him playing on the back end and get him playing on the back end well.
No, agreed. And, when it comes to the corner room, since we're talking about TJ Tampa, Keon Martin as well, shined on a lot of those special teams reps. So they're going to have a little bit of a roster crunch. But just getting back to Tampa, I can't emphasize enough how much I believe in the fit between TJ Tampa and Minter's defense. If he were playing on another defense, a Zach Orr, where there was a lot of confusion defense, I wouldn't believe in Tampa as much, but this is made for you to play your zone. I think TJ Tampa defends the high-low concept. His spacing is excellent. He comes up, and a lot of times, I haven't understood the run defense grades that I've seen on TJ Tampa or the tackling grades, because he will make sure that you don't get outside of him to the sideline, and he will push his blocker towards the ball carrier and really squeeze that space and sometimes get an arm on him. So I believe in him and coming up and rallying to make the tackle, which is what Minter's defense is all about. Make the quarterback check down and go and make a play, tackle, make them really, really earn it. So I love, he played the wing on punt coverage. So he was out there often down, one of the first men down on there. So you're punt protector, but obviously you don't get a full rush on most of those. So he's blitzing down the field, making plays. And he was in the one or two spot on kick coverage, which is the guys closest to the sideline. He was an important part of both of those units.
Let's talk about what the wing is here, because I think, and a lot of people don't know, but the wing is present on either a field goal kick or a punt special teams play. It's a slightly off the line of scrimmage. It looks kind of like an offset tight end. They're the third guy from the center on either side. So you have two wings, you have two gunners, that's four. You have five offensive linemen effectively, including the long snapper. You have the personal protector who's directly back, and people know what that is. And then you have the punter. Those are your 11 positions. So just, we get a chance like this. If you talk about what a wing does, we might as well give the people kind of a visual.
I love it. Yep, that's exactly right. So he's out there. Calais Campbell plays the wing on field goal box, because mm-hmm. you want somebody stout, long, who can, take on two gaps basically there. Tampa's role was, if they rush, he can block somebody, but really, he's a run and chase. He's set up to run and chase on punt coverage. And again, on the kick coverage, being the one or the two, those are the guys next to the sideline. So he's asked to contain and to crash, a very important role on special teams. So yeah, love his chances this year. And it's, we talked about the receiver room. I don't want it to happen by default or injuries, but I hope we get a better idea of what TJ Tampa can do as a corner this year.
So this show is sponsored by BetterHelp.com. For some, summer is their favorite season. Travel picks up, kids are out of school, and adventure is the focus. For others, juggling it all can be tough, can make you feel overwhelmed, and can make you count down the minutes until the kids are back in school. I know I look forward to summer as a time to take a break, but as a self-employed person, time spent away from my work is time I stress over wasting. That's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp is a quality therapist who work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the U.S., BetterHelp does the initial therapist matching for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences, and their 12 plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate means they typically get it right on the first time. If you aren't happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 6 million people globally, and it works. With an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on 1.7 million client reviews. You don't have to say yes to everything this summer. Find support in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com. That's betterhelp.com. There probably will be some opportunity that arises, because opportunity always arises at corner due to injury. It's not a matter of hoping that something happens due to injury. It's a matter of, you know, can rotation somehow be a supplement to what does happen and is almost virtually certain to happen at corner. But first of all, I don't think there's any danger that his roster spot would be lost to a host of young corners, which we'll talk about. The place where he could be on the field, I could see early on, would be if Humphrey is used in the slot corner on dime and there is one injury as well, or it might be an or there is one injury even, because Awuzie could move in and suddenly be a slot corner in that situation, or possibly even Tampa himself could, although he's not ideally suited to be it. But they play about, you know, 28 to 35% of their snaps in dime, let's say, this year, because they have a successful season. They're beating teams. Other teams are having to come back, and they go to the dime earlier in game. Like that creates a lot more opportunities for a player like Tampa to be on the field.
Yes, and even remember last year before Kyle was moved to dime, it was Awuzie as that dime linebacker. Marlon was in the slot, and TJ Tampa was on the field, early in the season. So when we get to the expectations, it's funny that kind of lines up with my expectations of good and great here.
All right. I think there's no doubt that the Ravens would want to give Tampa an expanded role and really figure out who he is this year. There's opportunity that comes along the path of a player's tenure. Third year is a very important year. I mean, the first opportunity to re-sign the guy occurs after year three. If you want to try and get him cheap, you really need to understand who he is at that point. And so it's very important for them to get Tampa on the field this year just for that reason. The other thing, from the player's perspective, you really don't want to go into year four with the team not really understanding or buying into who you are as a player. It makes you, unfortunately, a cut candidate there. And we saw that with JAD, for example, kind of a surprising cut to a lot of people. He clearly had something to offer at corner. The Ravens, you know, said they concerned over the cut, but in the end, they wanted to go with some younger guys.
And, you know, the special teams role for Tampa, I think, puts him in less danger than other mm-hmm. players. I mean, we saw Keaton Mitchell get let go because of the lack of special teams belief from the front office. So, to your point, yes. You know, ideally, you want to find out what a player has in by their third year. Absolutely.
Let's talk about the young corners that are out there competing now for the bottom of the roster here, which is a very tough group. But Marquise Robinson, who played extremely well during the preseason, is kind of a forgotten man in a lot of ways. And they have other guys who've come in as UDFAs, their long-term NFL vets. Or Awuzie is the long-term NFL vet, who at one point had 6 interceptions in a season for the Lions, but I don't think has much of a chance to make the roster this year. And then they have other young guys like McDoom, who doesn't really seem like the kind of player that the Ravens would take over some of these others. But they have Robert Longerbeam coming back. Longerbeam got one of the biggest personal plays, I think, so far of OTAs when he made the only interception in the last practice. And boy, was there a guy coming back from an injury, being a 6th-round pick originally, really needed one. Bill Alcone is back on the field. Chandler Rivers is just starting out now. Of course, a 5th-round draft pick, roster spot almost certainly not in jeopardy, but he'll be, where he is in the pecking order and if he plays or not, that is a question. And then Keon Martin, of course. And you know, Keon maybe in some jeopardy this year. He wasn't the selection of the current coaching staff, so he may have to prove himself again.
I could see them, you know, when you combine the safeties and the corners, 11 seems like the magic number. You can stretch that to 12. I believe they have kept 12 before. But what that comes down to me is you have room for, I would say, 7 corners is going to be the magic number there. Of course, we're you know, we're in May here, Ken, so it's kind of hard to tell. But Humphrey, Wiggins, Awuzie, Tampa, those four, you would think, figure are locks to make it. I think it's going to, and Chandler Rivers, to your point, should be there as a fifth round pick, who is just a great football player in the slot. That's five. I think Longer Beam is kind of faces an uphill climb. Could be Keon Martin, but yeah, I think with the overflow of guys who can play the slot. Sorry, I got a text message there. I got distracted. So Marlon can play the slot. Awuzie, you can move him if you want. Keon Martin can play the slot only. Rivers is a slot only. Longer Beam is a slot only. I don't think they're going to keep that many slot onlys, especially with a guy like Marlon who can play the slot as well. So
right.
I'm looking at, you know, Keon versus Longer Beam as a major competition. I think Kone kind of has a leg up because he can play outside corner and he's younger. So I kind of feel like Kone would be safer than Longer Beam and Keon. I think that's really the battle there.
One of the things you really notice about Chandler Rivers, and we had him at the podium in the first in the rookie minicamp, is he's very short. I mean, you stand out and you notice he's a small guy. Now that doesn't mean he doesn't have the dog in him or any of that, but didn't have a good coverage year in his last year at school. And it was a pretty good Duke team that he played on. And yet he didn't have a good coverage year. I do think, you know, the guy, unfortunately, that he reminds me of is Caillou Blue Kelly coming out of school and being in that exact round, being a guy who did not have in Kelly's case, did not have a good final year at Stanford. Stanford was a bad team is the difference between the two players is a significant difference. But I don't think that he gets a pass for, the fact that they drafted him like any pick in the fourth round or higher. He is likely to make the team. I think he's likely to make the team. I think he probably would be claimed, unlike a lot of other players. He's a player who probably does get claimed if he goes through waivers. But the Ravens have been, you know, pretty aggressive at trying to get people through waivers and onto the practice squad in the past few years. And it has caused them to lose a player or two.
Very true. Very true. That cornerback room, though, is there's a lot of options. And like you mentioned, there's a lot of turnover injury-wise in that room, you know, in that room on a year-to-year basis. I just see, you know, obviously guys who can play the slot, there's their own, you got undersized guys with Rivers, Keon, and Longer Beam, you know, slot only. Can you really afford to keep three slot only cornerbacks on your team? I'm not sure. You know, special teams comes into play and all that. So that's kind of the battle I'm looking at here early in May, obviously.
I'm with you entirely. And I'm not sure they can keep two slot only guys. Let me go to the extreme, because your slot is Kyle Hamilton. That's going to stay that way. I mean, as much as I don't know about what exactly Minter's defense is going to look like, that's the one thing I feel pretty sure putting a stake in the ground about is that they're going to play Kyle Hamilton.
And I don't understand why people miss this point. Yeah. I just, for the life of me, I can't understand why people, we're going to play nickel defense 60% of the time. I got the numbers written down, but it's going to be almost, you know, somewhere between, you have the numbers nickel we played last year and Minter played last year.
I do, but I got to bring it up.
Same over here. Okay. I have them, but I have to bring them up, but we're going to play a ton of nickel. That's our most played defense by far. And Kyle Hamilton is going to be the guy. Yeah. I have it right here. The Chargers played the third most dime last year. But you're talking about nickel and dime defense. Baltimore was almost two-thirds of the time. L.A. Chargers, over half of the time, they were in their nickel defense. And, of course, game situation and opponents play a lot into that if your opponent's going lighter or heavier. But Kyle Hamilton is starting, and it's not going to be at the safety position most of the time.
Okay, so here's the biggest number I can give you in this. The Ravens played four defensive backs, and that's the only time you'd have Kyle Hamilton at a position that is off the line of scrimmage and maybe a traditional strong safety role or even a goal line role or something else would be on the field otherwise. Yes. They only played 127 snaps with 1, 2, 3, or 4 defensive backs.
Right, so that's 4, two safeties. That's basically when Kyle Hamilton is playing safety, is what Ken's saying.
Playing a strong safety role, that's exactly right. And then they played with the nickel, they played 682 snaps of that, 256 snaps of dime. So you can see we're up at, you know, almost 90%. like the high 80s anyway, between nickel and dime.
Right.
But that's also, that's important, is that the 256 plus another six of quarter, by the way, that number probably was a little lower last year than we'd like it to be, because the Ravens didn't dominate games the way they had before.
That's
so they
right.
weren't working from positive game script, going to the dime earlier and saying, you know, look, you want to run the ball for 5 yards a shot, go ahead. We'll go run the clock out on yourself, but we're going to lay back here and we're going to play in a dime defense. You look back to 2019. Not only did they play a ton of dime, they played over 40% dime when they were dominating games so badly, but they also played more race car, more four outside linebacker packages. They're basically a get after the quarterback down after down defense. You play on a third down, obvious passing down. They played that more than they played the base defense that year. 13% of this race car and 10% of base defense. So the Ravens have become an extreme non-base team. And we're right. gonna have a pod coming out on this in the near future, which is about basically how Big Nickel is making both the inside linebacker position and the five tech position kind of die off. And yep. a lot of teams moving to Big Nickel. This is a Ravens. It's not entirely Ravens, because the Ravens got into it after Derwin James had already been really successful. But now, you know, the Seahawks have won a world championship with Nicky Minwari in that position. So there's a lot of players. At McNeil Warren this year came out in the draft. It seems to fit that kind of a role. But it's a very much a growing trend in the NFL.
Even Brandon Knuckles with the Steelers was the safety. And they cut whatever his name was, James Pierre, who had his flashes, your prototypical smaller nickel, to go with Brandon Knuckles at their nickel position when we played the Steelers. So, yeah, you're seeing it throughout the league. But, yeah, in addition to having the backup at slot corner, let's not forget that Kyle Hamilton is going to be in that nickel spot most of the time.
75% of the time.
He is kind of key to our defense. So, yeah. I mean, he can play dime linebacker on some of that 75% too. So, but he's not playing safety.
No, 75% is roughly the Big Nickel number. I'm saying, okay, maybe it's 65%, but 25 to 30% of dime is the opportunity for the slot corner position for corners who want to play
for
slot
corners.
It's yep. a relatively small amount. But you know, I don't also turn my nose up at that if I'm a slot corner playing for the Ravens. So I'm Chandler Rivers. I'm trying to get on the field. I'd love to get those 25% of snaps. First of all, they're the highest leverage snaps of all. Okay, so Hamilton's moving at a dime. You're on there on third and 10, third and eight, whatever. You got to stop the play. And, you're in position to shine or be, dumped upon if you're out there. And I think that's what most football players want. They want the high leverage snaps.
And so they're not immune to the trends either. They know.
Yeah.
They know that your 5'9", 5'10", slot corners are dying out, just like you see it a little bit on offense too. The 12 personnel with your Isaiah Likely or your Colston Loveland as that as your slot receiver instead of a Wes Welker and Edelman type.
Yeah, big slot flex. There you go. Sorry, a tight end flex. Yeah. The hard thing for the Ravens in this is going to be those five guys I talked about: Robinson, Longerbeam, Kone, Rivers, and Martin. They're all young guys, and they really need to figure out what they have. A couple of them, I think they're all in year two, except for Rivers. No, that's not true. Robinson is still year one. Longerbeam, Kone, because of IR, are in year two. Keon Martin in year two because of playing. And then Rivers is a rookie. So they've got three out of five that are still in year two. They need to find out who these guys are, and they need to sift through this talent, not during the regular season, because they can't afford to carry them all. And I'm with your model, by the way, exactly. I think the 7-4 is the ideal one. I think you gain a lot more upside value if you keep one more of these corners than if you keep Kayvon Wallace as a backup safety. I think, in fact, Kayvon, I don't think there's a long line of people waiting to pick him off waivers. I think he's a great veteran practice squad player. You can add to the roster as you need him.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. That's kind of where I'm leaning again, Ken. We're still pretty early in the process, but when I'm starting to crunch and look at the responsibilities, that's kind of how I see it.
So the biggest question, getting back to TJ Tampa for a moment, is do you explore a position change to safety possibly as early as this year? So you know, you've got, I think they're fairly committed, but we'll see how this plays out in terms of keeping Marlon Humphrey at corner and trying to see if he can get back to where he was just 2 years ago. Now, obviously had an injury riddled year, finished dead last in the PFF coverage ratings among all cornerbacks. And, you know, but then that's just a year removed from being a AP one guy. And so I wonder, you know, is there another player that they need to make their hybrid player? And the guy who makes a lot of sense is Tampa. I mean, he makes a lot of sense, as you've mentioned, and, you know, very eloquently in terms of being able to play within Minter's defense. If it's a very structured defense with tons of two high, that's going to give him an advantage in terms of being able to play an underneath zone, probably get to some balls, make some plays, and just play disciplined football in terms of pass offs. But I do think this team needs a player who can play both spots, and Tampa makes the most sense after Humphrey.
Okay, so I'm really happy that you mentioned this, because something that I brought up on my show, what I would like to see happen is, especially with the depth at slot corner that we've just gone over, exhausted, that Tampa cross trains a little bit, and specifically in that strong safety role during camp and in preseason. And the reason for this is Hawkins can play free safety. Malachi mm-hmm. Starks can play free safety. So you don't have to ask Tampa to learn both safety spots, you know, and put way too much on his plates. So how about outside corner, right corner, because he's a press corner. He's got those kind of skills. I think that Tampa is best suited, if they're going to play sides, to play on the right side of the defense, as you're, you know, guarding the X receiver and yep. taking the back half of cover three on that side. So right corner, strong safety. Those are your two positions. Try to learn strong safety. And of course, we're dumbing down the terms here a little bit, but that's kind of where I see Tampa going, because I think you want to make sure he gets his time at outside corner, especially considering that Marlon Humphrey and Chido Awuzie, they're not younger players. You may end up going into next year as Tampa being one of your options as a starting corner. But at the same time, Ken, depth at safety, position flexibility, roster crunch. Tampa is a smart player. We saw him play all over the place again at Iowa State. So I think mentally it's something that he could handle in his third year in the NFL. So I'm really happy that you brought that up, because that's an idea I've been exploring on my channel a little bit as well.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. We've talked about it too. I think the one that makes even more sense is moving Humphrey there, but that only really made a lot of sense if they'd spent draft capital at the corner position this year. And I'm not talking about fifth round draft capital to get a slot corner in Chandler Rivers. I'm talking about getting somebody at the top of the draft. If they had Mansoor Delane drop into their laps, for example, mm-hmm. or if they'd have, if McCoy would have had to been healthier. Who was the other guy? Tyrion Arnold. That's not the correct
Colton name. Hood.
Colton Hood. Chris Johnson in the second round was a guy I was really excited yeah. about as a possibility. And then he went very early. Who am I thinking? Okay.
Brandon Cisse was in there as well. I think he was like more end of the second, but they had some outside corners there. That's not where we went. And I'm glad we didn't. Like, I like how we did the draft. I think it turned out well as far as like the need plus BPA. I thought it was a pretty good draft, especially the first two.
And they did a good job with, I think, minimizing draft capital at positions where Minter has proven to have success working with less.
That's
right. Specifically, I'm talking about inside linebacker and corner. It's great to have a defensive-minded coach who isn't screaming for defensive players and say, look, we've got to be the best team we can be overall. You don't need to get me a great defensive player. Give me a good wide receiver. You know, we already got Lane. Go ahead and get me Surratt too. And I don't know if he was really behind it in that kind of way. But he said that was okay, because he can play with less on defense. And inside linebacker, by the way, position the Ravens certainly could have drafted and emphasized more. I thought that might have been one of the surprise picks if a player like Anthony Hill had dropped into their laps. And Anthony Hill went at number 60, but he really fell down the boards. I thought he's way too good a player to be drafted that late. Way too good.
He was great in pass coverage. He was great at blitzing, I believe. He had a lot of skills. But again, that Will linebacker, Ken, we were talking about, your base defense is dying, and you're playing one out of every five snaps, maybe, 20% of base defense with the two linebackers. You want to go dime. Jesse Minter.
Just hold on. I got to stop you for a second here. That Will linebacker is going to play more like one minus the percentage of dime snaps. It's going to be more like 70% the Will linebacker plays, which is why, you know, a player like,
excuse me. Yes, I messed up there. I was talking about dime, but your Will linebacker again is a, you know, is the emphasis has been off of that, in recent years. What was I about to say? Oh, Jesse Minter, more with less. You're looking at a Chargers team that only gave up 16 touchdowns, had 19 interceptions. Tony Jefferson had 4 interceptions. We mentioned the corners, the late round picks. Jesse Minter comes off to me as someone who's extremely confident in his defensive philosophy, and he's got more talent right now. He had more talent before the draft in Baltimore than he did out there in L.A. And look what he did with Adafi Owe in that secondary. He don't have superstars in L.A. like he did here. When you're talking about possibly Matt Ibike, Roquan, Kyle Hamilton, those are some really good players that the Ravens have on defense. And I'm looking forward to, Ken, seeing us. Like, I feel like these players were underperforming, and I don't think that it was all on them. I'm looking forward to having guys on defense overperform.
Right.
Travis Jones. I mean, we have some monsters on defense.
Yeah, it's an imposing group. I mean, a lot of it comes down to health every year, but they're penciled in starting front four. They're passing down unit that they could potentially put out there that has a lot of options already in terms of, you know, kicking Tavius or Zion inside if Namdi isn't completely ready to go. And the only guy that they're completely dependent upon right now, the two guys, I guess, are Travis Jones and Trey Hendrickson. If either of those guys got hurt, the units take a sharp turn downward, because they really, there's nobody to replace those guys.
Exactly. But, you know, I don't think he had those type of guys in LA either, you know, and the results were outstanding. He's going to have more talent here in Baltimore. I don't think we're ever going to be a team that scrimps by on defense, where I'm just really looking forward to the Jesse Minter Baltimore Ravens on the defensive side of the ball, and that becoming something that we can lean on in tough times for the offense, you know, whether it just we're pacing, it's that kind of day, bad weather, whatever it is, to where we can count on our defense to make a stop while our offense is out of rhythm.
Yep. Completely with you. I'm so excited to see what this defense looks like. We'll see a little bit of it this summer, but I won't see even very much, I don't think, at camp, because they're looking at a lot of players the preseason. You know, part of it is they kind of want to hide everything until they get into the season. But another part of it is they have a ton of players to look at. So they got to go out of more basic formations. You play a lot of committed nickel during the preseason. That's not what you're going to play during the regular season. You're going to play all kinds of dimes and specialized defenses and sub packages when you get to the regular season. But I am so excited to see when the regular season comes along and just how Minter deploys this defense differently. And I think we'll get we're going to have tons of fun surprises to talk about in those early weeks.
Yeah, when people ask me about the offense, I have a lot of question marks. I don't know. But when people ask me about the defense, I'm borderline cocky at this point, Ken. you know, I just feel like that what I've seen from Jesse Minter from studying, the more you study, the more you get to realize that he's getting the best out of players. I mean, look what Owe did over there. Look what Tony Jefferson did over there. He's got a 2-year resume there in L.A. of, big edges. I mean, it's just, you add Trey Hendrickson to this group and it gets really exciting.
Yeah, you exactly match my level of cockiness on each side of the ball. If I said, how sure am I about what the offense will look like, it's 10 or 15%. I mean, seriously. Yeah,
no idea.
No idea how Doyle's going to run this. You know, we're trying to project forward from two different trees he's worked in with Ben Johnson and with Peyton. And we don't really know. We really don't know what's happening. The people who do say they know, I just think they're full of crap. I mean, honestly,
One last note on that. I feel that, and again, it's all guesswork, like we're saying, but I feel like people are overstudying the Ben Johnson offense and understudying the Sean Payton
offense. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And but that doesn't make me any more than 10 or 15% sure still, because he's going to bring his own wrinkle to this as a play caller and with the weapons he's got. If he's the best coordinators, of course, match their offense or defense up to exactly the personnel they have, as opposed to playing a strict formation. Now, they may choose their personnel or try and influence the choice of personnel to kind of match kind of a base philosophy they have. And we're on the fortunate side on the defense that Kyle Hamilton matches up pretty similarly to who Derwin James is.
Yes.
In terms of Well, he was successful with that already. Now he happens to have a very similar, you know, best player on the team who can bring a lot of that. So
I love that, Ken. I love that.
So 10 or 15 and 75. Those are my levels of surety.
Something like that. Yeah, same here. And, you know, the one game I would say from the Bears that gave me the most optimism is if you go back and watch Bears versus Eagles last year and the Bears run the ball down Philadelphia's throat, I want to say they had high 200s in rushing yards. The way that they were able to negate Jalen Carter almost reminded me of that Rams game in 2019 where Aaron Donald didn't have a stat registered, the Greg Roman game, to where, yes, we're going to be a heavy outside zone rush team. That's our bread and butter. But to see Declan Doyle and Ben Johnson's flexibility in that Philly game to really run all kinds of different run concepts, mix it up, and to stick with the run versus an excellent defense really gives me hope. I know that it wasn't, it's a Ben Johnson offense, but Declan Doyle put together that game plan from everything we saw. And so that makes me optimistic. I think that we can switch it up with the guards that we have, the aggressive size, and really give teams problems in different ways on offense. But yeah,
there's a whole lot of things we should talk about in terms of the offense. We have to save it for another show here. Let's talk some TJ Tampa. And what does a good season look like for TJ Tampa for you?
Okay, TJ Tampa, a good season. I'm going to make this pretty specific. I want to see him be a starter in the dime defense, and I'm looking at that right cornerback position. So by the end of the season, of course, not to start the season, you'll have Chidobe and you'll have Marlon probably playing well and being healthy. But I would, if this is a good season for TJ Tampa, he's someone that they count on in that dime defense to be one of the six DBs that are out there.
Okay, so he's not going to play ahead of Wiggins. That means he's got to play ahead of either Humphrey or Ouzie at some point during the season. And you're hoping that doesn't occur because of injury, because you said that earlier. You're hoping it occurs because of ability.
Yeah, and I'm looking at, you know, Ouzie specifically. So maybe in that scenario, Marlon is your nickel or your slot corner. Kyle is at the dime linebacker, and TJ Tampa would be your right corner. That's kind of, if I had to spell it out, that would be a good season. It would show that, you know, he's got the trust from those coaches. And I think, you know, Ken, that we'll see him be able to play that role at points during the season due to injury and due to game situations. Maybe the Ravens are ahead. They want to get Ouzie off his feet. They want to get Marlon off his feet. But by the end of the season, to where they're confident enough in TJ Tampa to where he is one of their best, you know, players, one of their best six in dime, one of their best three corners.
That would be a very good result for the Baltimore Ravens, to be sure. I'll go through a good season for me. Stays healthy for camp to explore positional options. Very important. He's not going to be converted to safety if he's not healthy during camp. So he's got to do that. Get some reps in the preseason to stay sharp, but he's a starter with an early retiree from games. So he's already given the starter treatment. He'll be in there for, you know, two series, three series, come off the field. Some reps to stay sharp are fine, but honestly, at this point in his career, I'm not even sure he really needs those. The regular season includes some stand-in time at outside corner to go with some rotational time, and ideally because he earned it. Talking about it much in the same way you did, Ouzie had a fantastic year in 2025. He is not an easy guy to dislodge from that right corner position that Tampa, you know, is ideally suited to stand in for. I want him to earn it, and I don't want Ouzie to learn to lose it. I think that's similar to what you're saying here. I'd say a good season, this again, the 60th percentile, he totals between 15 and 40% of the snaps. It could be as low as 15 if Ouzie continues to play well. Humphrey rebounds to, say, the middle of the league. I think 15% of snaps is possible. Wouldn't be terrible. It'd be slightly more than he played this last year, maybe up to 170 snaps or so. But he could play 40% of the snaps if there are injuries, and I think at the 60th percentile, there's a good chance he's in that range, allowing the Ravens to get a good read on development and impact of his limited speed. So by the end of 2025, the Ravens need to find out if, within Minter's scheme, can Tampa be successful as a corner with the limitations he brings to the field, as well as all of the positives, the physicality and the smarts and whatnot. I want to see those two put together. I hope he flashes, leaves fans wanting more in terms of playing time. as the Ravens have to then plan for a 2027 with the possible departures of Awuzie and Humphrey. So, you know, if they would be severely remiss if they didn't get some playing time from corners four and five at least this year to try and figure out if they're part of the 2027 plans, because it may actually impair their ability to part ways with Awuzie and Humphrey. This team needs to get a lot younger, and one of the ways they can ease some of that is to understand what they have in this corner room if Awuzie and Humphrey are out the door.
Love that, and just want to go back and rewind and touch on the, let's call it Tampa versus Awuzie point. When it comes to run support, physicality, and that kind of thing, I think that's where TJ Tampa can make his mark over Awuzie. And to where, okay, it's not that Awuzie is playing poorly. Maybe we see a similar performance as last year where Awuzie looks good out there, but Tampa looks just as good out there, but he's better in run support. Mm-hmm. would be the pathway that I'm looking for in time. So I don't think he has to outplay Awuzie by a mile. He's just got to be stylistically the choice and play well and make that part of his game show up.
All right, love it. Love it. Talk about a great season. What does that look like?
Yeah, this is probably my weakest, you know, as far as not having parameters around here, but I'll try to talk it through the best I can. To where you go into the draft next year and you don't feel like you have a have to overdraft a corner. So I don't know if you like presumptive starter might be too strong of a term. But where TJ Tampa is, like, you feel comfortable with him in that room as, you know, hey, we'll bring in maybe a young guy, but we don't have to draft a corner in the first round. Of course, there's a lot of moving parts here. Where's Marlon? That kind of thing. Do we sign a free agent corner? But to where you would be comfortable going into 2027 with Wiggins as Tampa as your starters. Again, it's not the best way to put it. You could clip this and pick on my language, but the confidence to be basically the team has confidence in Tampa to be a starter in 2027 in his free agent year and let him cash.
I think in some ways that's the most important question to answer. So I don't find anything wrong with your description at all. And you'll notice mine's kind of similar. Great season. I think he's forced into a trial by fire due to injury. He passes the test with a fine season as a plus cornerback in 400 plus snaps. Remember I said between 15 and 40% might be a good season. So I think he's north of that. And probably it's not going to come all due to his own play. It might be that if he were to get on the field because Awuzie is hurt early and then he outplays what Awuzie had done or what they expect out of Awuzie, then Awuzie might not be able to get his job back. That could happen. And that would be actually a very good situation for
Tampa. Or if the Ravens just have a bunch of leads, Ken, hey, you know, we got to.
Well, let me go the other direction here because if he does get on the field, I think he has the chance to Wally Pipp. You know, be Lou Gehrig, hit Lou Gehrig to Wally Pipp as
yes.
Awuzie, in terms of holding the positions. So I think that's very positive. And alternatively, he's forced into action, plays a competent split field, and provides the Ravens with an option on his development path. That's a split field safety role, so that they lose a safety. Perhaps they lose Starks, or that'd be horrible, of course. Or they lose. The
Hawkins, right?
It really would have to be Starks or Hawkins, wouldn't it? Because if they've got to avoid moving Hamilton to the back end, and then you use Tampa as the band-aid for the position, you know, potentially on a short term, and they don't bring up Kayvon Wallace, and then he plays a competent split field there, and gives the Ravens that positional option going forward. A cornerback will remain, I believe, no matter what, a 2027 draft priority. In any case, just to the age of Awuzie and Humphrey. So it doesn't. I think that Tampa's chance to move up more than one net spot on the totem pole is not very high, but that's okay because one net spot still gets them a lot of playing time in 2027. Still get a more expected playing time in 2027 than where he is right now. But the Ravens got to figure it out, and I think if he plays 400 plus snaps, which is the 80th percentile, then the Ravens may well explore an extension before or during the 2027 season. So remember, he cannot be signed to an extension until the end of the 26th season, because that'll be the end of his third year. So they could do it as early as, you know, next offseason at some point if they really loved who he was as a player. Or it could be that they do what they've done with some other players and they extend him during the season in his fourth year, which would also be exciting. So that's that'd be like the Travis Jones method, we'll call it. But I'd like to see him, you know, think about that. They've got some players this year, by the way, Tavis Robinson among them, who they've got to make decisions on for 2027 right now. What do you think about that? A chance they sign Tavius either this offseason or during the 26 season?
I think it's very possible. I do think that there is unquestionably overlap with
Young.
Yeah, with Zion Young. And then, you know, I know that the, you know, their edge positions are different positions, whether you're playing rush side or strong side, but you also have Trey Hendrickson and Mike Green signed up for the next few years as well. They're going to be on this team. So you look at the other three guys in that edge room, and they're here for the long haul in NFL terms. So that would be the only thing that holds me back. At the same time, Tavius has proven to be a humble Raven type player. You know, if I can be a Jarrett Johnson, that would be great. We've kind of heard him say that. So I could definitely see a scenario in which he signs. I think that what works against him is that this room is very crowded, you know, with Zion, Trey, and Mike Green all being on this team for at least the next 3-4 years.
Yeah. All right. Fair enough. Anything else about Tampa and the possibility of extending him?
Yeah. With TJ Tampa, I think that that's completely possible, and I would be really excited for it. I think someone like him may realize that his value is with the Ravens and that other teams just don't have as much of a use for a corner who lacks that long speed, as you mentioned. A 4.59 corner is not for every team. So he could see his fit here, be like, hey, TJ, we're not going to pay you, obviously, you know, anywhere near top cornerback value. But what we'll do is we'll give you this, like, remember Rashad Bateman's original contract with the Ravens, where it was like, we're giving you that security that you got a spot and we want you here. And you can have the potential to earn more. If you're our starter, we'll re-up you like we did Rashad, to have that kind of role. But yeah, I can see it. I think it's more possible for a guy like TJ Tampa, you know, considering that he's playing this kind of hybrid responsibility with a bunch of named players in that room with Wiggins, Owusie, and Marlon. So, yeah. And again, the scarcity of teams that would be willing to use him.
All right. Jason, always a pleasure talking football with you. And one thing that's a constant in any conversation with you is that time gets away from us. So we've been a little bit longer than we would on a normal episode. I hope people appreciate the organic football discussion. Tell folks where they can find your material online.
Sure. It's Huddle It Up Films on YouTube. I'm also on X as well. But YouTube is where I would urge people to go to for the content. You know, highlights from the All-22 from the coaches tape on every Raven last year, as long as they had enough to make a highlight tape. So you're talking about offensive linemen and guys like Keon Martin and Keandre, they earn their snaps through the special team portion. You can see these guys. And, you know, I think it's a good supplement for Ken, who's the best in the business, not one of the best when it comes to the offensive line grading and the consistencies. You know, even when I disagree with Ken on that, I mean, he's scheduling it or he's scoring it by the book. So I put out cut-ups during the season, basically of the O-line. Maybe it's their pass protection that week. Maybe it's their run blocking. Same on the defensive line. How do they look on third downs? What are their pass rush snaps? Maybe isolating a player. But I would ask for the support over on YouTube. If you really want to support me, go over there, log in, and just subscribe. And that's all I ask. And I think that you'll find the content helpful to you if you like Ken's show.
I appreciate your comments, Jason, and always, as always, your friendship and your willingness to participate on this show. Love to do more with you on whoever's show, because it's always fun to have that discussion. I don't normally promote my YouTube channel either. It's not something I've focused on at all. But I have more of the short videos that show up there. My wife has been a big proponent of doing that. Maureen's taking a bigger hand in producing elements of that. And I'd like to get people over subscribed to my YouTube channel as well, at Film Study. Please give that a look.
There you go. So yeah, the perfect. I see you're popping up on my algorithm, which is good. So I see you over there, and sometimes I'll listen to your show over there instead of, you know, the traditional way.
I appreciate you, Jason. Thanks again for coming on.
Ken, thank you. Love you. Thanks for everybody for listening.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.